All right. That's the great late Della Reese, who died on November the 20th, 2017. She was 86 years old, a very strong force in black culture. And the song, Somebody's Calling My Name, had put me in mind of Dr. Martin Luther King, who was a true servant. And the song seems to say, here is somebody asking God, what do you want me to do? And we knew that King had the answer. And so we commemorate him today in a very special way. I want to talk about what we're about to hear. And what we're about to hear is the intellectual backing for King's involvement in civil rights. People think that, well, he organized people. He just told them to show up. No. There was an intellectual work here. And we're about to appreciate that in this interview that was given to NBC's Sander Van Oker in 1967, 11 months before Dr. King's assassination. But here you have to appreciate the genius of the man and the depth of his commitment and his intellect when he's discussing what informed this struggle, this people's struggle. So here is Sander Van Oker having a conversation with King at King's Church, Ebenezer Baptist Church in Atlanta, Georgia. And he's trying to understand, and it's interesting how King, without even intending to, but just approaching the conversation from the point of view of a teacher, but giving a very deep education that contradicts many people's view that, well, it wasn't all that deep. It was just people getting together. So I want you to listen to King delineate what informed this movement. Sander Van Oker interviewing Dr. Martin Luther King in 1967.
Civil Rights, King, Van Oker, Roll 20, Sound 36.
Dr. King, this church is as good a place as any to go back over your commitment to the civil rights movement. When you went out from here into university and then you went to Montgomery, Alabama and started the bus boycotts there, what was the philosophy of the civil rights movement as you saw it then, more than 10 years ago?
Well, I would say then the philosophy was that we must go all out to use legal and nonviolent methods to gain full citizenship rights for the Negro people of our country. Of course, that particular struggle and that philosophy centered on breaking down all of the barriers of legal segregation. So I would say that in that period, The basic thrust for the gaining of citizenship rights for Negroes was to end the humiliation surrounding the whole system of legal segregation.
Dr. King, was there something peculiar to the place where you started and the kind of people you attracted? I mean by that, there was a strong attachment on the part of your parishioners in Montgomery to the church. They were older people, weren't they?
Yes, I would say by and large they were older people who participated in the boycott because they were the ones using the bus more than anybody else. And Montgomery was a community, predominantly church senate, so that it was very easy to get to the vast majority of Negroes because they were in some way connected with a church in the community.
Sir, in addition to your commitment to the idea of nonviolence, wasn't it also the only thing you could do, the white community having the monopoly on violence, that if you had tried violence, they would have met it with violence? It was the only device open to you, wasn't it?
Well, I'll put it another way, that morally, I was led to nonviolence because I felt that it was the best moral way to deal with the problem. We were seeking to establish a just society. And it was my feeling then, and it is my feeling now, that violence is certainly much more socially destructive, and it creates many more social problems than it solves. So I was led to nonviolence for deep moral reasons. Now, there is no doubt about the fact that in our struggle in Montgomery and all over the United States for that matter, nonviolence is also practically sound. It would just be impractical for the Negro to turn to violence. He has neither the instruments nor the techniques of violence. We are about 10 or 11% of the total population of the nation, and I would say we are about 0.1% of the firepower. So it would just be totally impractical and unwise and unrealistic for the Negro to think of violence. Well, I saw this in the beginning in Montgomery, but this wasn't the basic reason that I turned to nonviolence and that I believed in it as a philosophy. I turned to it because I felt that it was the morally excellent way to deal with the problem of racial injustice in our country.
Is there something about nonviolence that made it, and I use that in the past tense, that made it more useful among Southern Negroes than the ghetto Negroes of the North?
I wouldn't say there's anything that makes it more useful to Southern Negroes. I think it is true that we've had more nonviolent movements in the South because the problem for many years was more crystallized and, in a sense, more visible in the South. We didn't have many civil rights activities on a massive scale in the North until 3 or 4 years ago. So I would say that we just haven't had a chance to experiment on a broad scale with nonviolence in the Northern ghetto. I have the feeling that nonviolence is as applicable and workable in the Northern ghetto as it is in the South. Now, there's a larger job there. The frustrations at points are much deeper. The bitterness is deeper. And I think that's because in the South we can see pockets of progress here and there. We've really made some strides that are very visible, and every Southern Negro knows that he can do things today that he couldn't do 4 or 5 years ago. Wherein in the North, the Negro sees only retrogress, and he doesn't find it as easy to get his vision centered on his target, the target of opposition, as he does in the South. Consequently, this is made for despair and at many points cynicism, a feeling that you can't win. And it simply means that we've got to develop in the North a massive job of organization and mobilizing forces and resources to deal with the problem in the urban ghettos of the North, just as we've done it in the South.
In the South, particularly in Alabama, you had visible villains, Jim Clark, Bull Connor, cattle prods, police dogs. But in the North, you don't have those visible villains. Isn't it hard to get your people aroused and directed at something that isn't visible?
Well, that's exactly right, and this is what I was saying when I said it's harder to see a target. In the South, in the nonviolent movement, we were aided always, on the whole, by the brutality of our opponent. It isn't the same way in the North. The other thing is that you don't have legal segregation in the North as you do in the South. So it is much more difficult to get people to see exactly what you're doing, but it isn't an impossible job. It's a hard, it's a tedious job at times to get people to be aroused from their apathetic slumbers, but I still feel that Negroes in the North can be motivated just as they were motivated in the South. And I think as time goes on with the growing economic deprivation in the Negro community, it will even be easier because people will come to see that not only is something wrong in general, but something is wrong in particular in their own economic and housing situations.
Well, what is it? I mean, how do you find it? It's very subtle in the North, is it not?
It's subtle, but it's becoming much more visible. Anybody can see that the schools are more segregated in the North today than they were in 1954 when the Supreme Court rendered its decision declaring segregation unconstitutional. Anybody can look around the ghetto and see that ghetto schools are predominantly segregated and devoid of quality. Anyone who moves through a major ghetto of our country will see the housing conditions. People don't have to be reminded that they are forced to live in slums in many instances, and they're often rat-infested, vermin-filled slums. And it isn't too hard to see the exploitation that the Negro confronts in the ghetto, where he is forced to pay more for less and constantly trying to make ends meet, but because of either no job as a result of unemployment, a job that is so economically unprofitable that the person can't make ends meet. And I think they see all of these things, and more they are coming to see them, because before, the people of the North were looking to the South and they supported the struggles of the South. Now they are coming to see that their problems are very real and they've got to organize to grapple with them.
Was there something hypocritical about the fact that the South existed and the North could point the finger? And then when the Civil Rights Acts were passed in the early 60s, you couldn't point the finger anymore?
Well, there was no doubt about the hypocrisy of large segments of the nation on the whole question of racial equality. I think the best example is that many of the senators from the North and the West, and congressmen generally, who voted for civil rights legislation in 64 and even 65 with the Voting Rights Bill, refused last year to vote for civil rights legislation because it dealt with an issue applicable to the North, the whole housing question. And this, it seems to me, was the greatest expression of the hypocrisy of many of our citizens and many of the senators and congressmen of the North.
But isn't that part of the dilemma now? That people knew that Negroes were being denied what was guaranteed to them by the Constitution, by the fact that they were citizens of this country. Then when they were given those rights, do you feel the white community said, well, we've given them all that we have, now it's up to them?
Well, I think the dilemma is much deeper, and I think one during this period of transition has to be very honest with America. And honesty impels me to admit that America has broad racist elements still alive. Racism is still existing in American society, in many areas of the society, North and South. And the other thing is that there has never been a single, solid, determined commitment of large segments of white America on the whole question of racial equality. I think we have to see that vacillation has always existed, ambivalence has always existed, and this to me is the so-called white backlash. It's merely a new name for an old phenomenon. I see the white backlash as a continuation of the same ambivalence and vacillation of white America on the whole question of racial justice that has existed since the founding of our nation. I think the other thing that we must see at this time is that many of the people who supported us in Selma, in Birmingham, were really outraged about the extremist behavior toward Negroes. But they were not at that moment, and they are not now, committed to genuine equality for Negroes. It's much easier to integrate a lunch counter than it is to guarantee an annual income, for instance, to get rid of poverty for Negroes and all poor people. It's much easier to integrate a bus than it is to make genuine integration a reality and quality education a reality in our schools. It's much easier to integrate even a public park than it is to get rid of slums. And I think we are in a new era, a new phase of the struggle, where we have moved from a struggle for decency, which characterized our struggle for 10 or 12 years, to a struggle for genuine equality. And this is where we are getting the resistance, because there was never any intention to go this far. People were reacting to Bull Connor and to Jim Clark rather than acting in good faith for the realization of genuine equality.
Do you think white people in this country, and I'm talking about non-segregationists, people devoid or thinking they're devoid of racism, do you have any idea of what they want the Negro to be in America?
Well, it depends on the level that we are talking here, because I think you have to make a distinction between the people who are genuinely and absolutely committed in the white community on the question of racial equality. And I must confess that I think they're in a very small minority. I think the vast majority of white Americans will go but so far. It's a kind of installment plan for equality. And they are always looking for an excuse to go but so far.
Why are they looking for the excuse? What is it about the Negro? I mean, every other group that came as an immigrant somehow, not easily, but somehow got around it. Is it just the fact that Negroes are black?
That's a part of it, and growing, that grows out of something else. You can't thingify anything without depersonalizing that something. If you use something as a means to an end, at that moment you make it a thing and you depersonalize it. The fact is that the Negro was a slave in this country for 244 years. That act, that was a willful thing that was done. The Negro was brought here in chains, treated in very inhuman fashion. And this led to the thingification of the Negro. So he was not looked upon as a person. He was not looked upon as a human being with the same status and worth as other human beings. And the other thing is that human beings cannot continue to do wrong without eventually rationalizing that wrong. So slavery was justified morally, biologically, theoretically, scientifically, everything else. And it seems to me that white America must see that no other ethnic group has been a slave on American soil. That is one thing that other immigrant groups haven't had to face. The other thing is that the color became a stigma. American society made the Negro's color a stigma. And that can never be overlooked. So I think these things are absolutely necessary. The other thing is that America freed the slaves in 1863 through the Emancipation Proclamation of Abraham Lincoln, but gave the slaves no land or nothing in reality, and as a matter of fact, to get started on. At the same time, America was giving away millions of acres of land in the West and the Midwest, which meant that there was a willingness to give the white peasants from Europe an economic base. And yet it refused to give its black peasants from Africa who came here involuntarily in chains and had worked free for 244 years any kind of economic base. And so emancipation for the Negro was really freedom to hunger. It was freedom to the winds and rains of heaven. It was freedom without food to eat or land to cultivate, and therefore it was freedom and famine at the same time. And when white Americans tell the Negro to lift himself by his own bootstraps, they don't look over the legacy of slavery and segregation. I believe we ought to do all we can and seek to lift ourselves by our own bootstraps, but it's a cruel jest to say to a bootless man that he ought to lift himself by his own bootstraps. And many Negroes, by the thousands and millions, have been left bootless as a result of all of these years of oppression and as a result of a society that deliberately made his color a stigma and something worthless and degrading.
Apart from wanting to live better, which all of us want to do, to raise one's children in a better way, to be better, does the Negro in America know what he wants to be?
I'm convinced that almost every Negro in this country, other than those who have been so scarred by the system that they've become pathological in the process, and we all have to battle with pathology, nobody really knows what it means to be a Negro unless one can really experience it. And I know we all have to battle with this constant drain of a feeling of nobodiness. But in spite of this, I think the vast majority of Negroes in this country know that they want to be people, they want to be men, they want equality, period. It just boils down to that. And we haven't been able to be people. We haven't been men because of all of the conditions that we've lived with and the syndrome of deprivation surrounding conditions, whether it's in housing, in the economic area, or in schools, or in the vicious credit practices that we face in the ghetto, and all of the problems of closed doors and constant defeats. But in spite of all this, I think we all know, basically, that we want to be men. We want to be persons judged not on the basis of the color of our skin, but on the basis of the content of our character.
But you know that many young Negroes don't want anything that smacks of the American white middle class. But do they want something that smacks of whatever is the black middle class, or do they just not want bourgeois values, which after all are the basis of this democracy?
Well, I think we have to see what they are saying. I would be the first to agree that integration does not mean giving up everything that has an Afro-American taint, so to speak, a background. I think there are certain unique things within any culture and certain cultural patterns that when you get to the process of amalgamation can really lift the whole culture. And it seems to me that integration at its best is the opportunity to participate in the beauty of diversity. I think the other thing that we've got to see is that these young people are saying that there must be a revolution of values in our country. As Jimmy Baldwin said on one occasion, what advantage is there in being integrated into a burning house? And I feel that there is a need for a revolution of values in America, because some of the values that presently exist are certainly out of line with the values and the idealistic structure that brought our nation into being. Unfortunately, we haven't been true to these ideals, and many of the values of so-called white middle-class society are values that need to be reviewed and re-evaluated, and in a real sense, they need to be changed. So I think the young people in the Negro community who are raising these questions are raising some very profound questions about our total society. In other words, they are saying that there must be a restructuring of the architecture of our society where values are concerned. And with this, I would agree with. So in the quest for integration, I think we can offer our whole nation something, because there are three evils in our nation. It's not only racism, but economic exploitation of poverty would be one, and then militarism. And I think in a sense, and in a very real sense, these three are tied inextricably together, and we aren't going to get rid of one without getting rid of the other.
When you stood on the Lincoln Memorial that day in August, 63, and you said, "I had a dream," did that dream envision that you could see a war in Asia preventing the federal government doing for the Negroes, preventing the society doing for the Negroes, that which you think had to be done?
No, I didn't envision that then. I must confess that that period was a great period of hope for me, and I'm sure for many others all across the nation. Many of the Negroes who had about lost hope saw a solid decade of progress in the South. And in 1954, which was, 64, 1963, 9 years after the Supreme Court's decision to be in the March on Washington, meant a great deal. It was a high moment, a great watershed moment. But I must confess that that dream that I had that day has at many points turned into a nightmare. Now, I'm not one to lose hope. I keep on hoping. I still have faith in the future. But I've had to analyze many things over the last few years, and I would say over the last few months. I've gone through a lot of soul-searching and agonizing moments, and I've come to see that we have many more difficult days ahead, and some of the old optimism was a little superficial, and now it must be tempered with a solid realism. And I think the realistic fact is that we still have a long, long way to go, and that we are involved in a war on Asian soil, which, if not checked and stopped, can poison the very soul of our nation.
Dr. King, even if there had not been a war in Asia, would you still not have had this nightmare, insofar as the Negro movement for equality then touched on two things that the white community holds sacred, their children and their property?
Oh, I have no doubt that we would have encountered great difficulties, great problems of resistance, if the war had not been in existence. So that I'm not going to say that all of our problems would be solved if the war in Vietnam is ended. But I do say that the war makes it infinitely more difficult to deal with these problems. When a nation becomes obsessed with the guns of war, it loses its social perspective, and programs of social uplift suffer. This is just a fact of history, so that we do face many more difficulties as a result of the war. It's much more difficult to really arouse a conscience during a time of war. I noticed the other day, some weeks ago, a Negro was shot down in Chicago, and it was a clear case of police brutality. That was on page 30 of the paper, but on page 1 at the top was 780 Viet Cong killed. That is something about a war like this that makes people insensitive. It dulls the conscience. It strengthens the forces of reaction, and it brings into being bitterness and hatred and violence. And it strengthened the military-industrial complex of our country, and it's made our job much more difficult, because I think we can go along with some programs, if we didn't have this war on our hands, that would cause people to adjust to new developments, just as they did in the South. They said they'd never ride the bus with us, blood would flow in the streets, they wouldn't go to school, and all of these things. But when people came to see that they had to do it because the law insisted, they finally adjusted. And I think white people all over this country will adjust once the nation makes it clear that in schools, in housing, we've got to learn to live together as brothers. I think the biggest problem now is that we got our gains over the last 12 years at bargain rate, so to speak. Didn't cost the nation anything. In fact, it helped the economic side of the nation to integrate lunch counters and public accommodations. It didn't cost the nation anything to get the right to vote established. And now we are confronting issues that cannot be solved without costing the nation billions of dollars. Now, I think this is where we are getting our greatest resistance. They may put it on many other things, but we can't get rid of slums and poverty without it costing the nation something.
I just wanted to share with you the profundity of thought that it just flows as if, you know, he's reading from a text, but this is intellectual heft that we are listening to here from Dr. Martin Luther King. And the way he was deconstructing what was happening in the country then and how he had to maneuver, how he had to influence people, how he had to control things in a way so that people stayed on point. And by the way, I remind you that this interview with Sander Van Ocker of NBC News was done in 1967, just a mere 11 months before Dr. King was assassinated. So as you can hear from what he himself is saying, a lot of thought, a lot of analysis, a lot of research had gone into his own preparation for how best he could use himself in this burgeoning movement. This was not, you know, show up and stand in front of a mic talk. You can hear the intellectual preparation, the cognition there, of the complexities of a burgeoning struggle. But he seemed quite comfortable with his role. And of course, we knew that it ended tragically. But we are also finding out in this interview that he was preparing himself. He had been preparing himself. And in order to do that, he also prepared himself to study and learn the environment in which he was about to function as a leader. This was no accident at all. This was not a casual venture. This was something that he devoted his life to. And I believe that he was prepared. I have no proof whatsoever of this, but I believe his determination was such that he was prepared for what was coming, not only because he believed that what he and others were doing would have made progress possible, but also that he did not have to be afraid because he was on a special mission from on high. So he had no fear of that. The same people say of Malcolm X. It was clear that he understood how precarious things were and that he could be killed at any time. But he wasn't paralyzed by that. He looked longer down the road and saw that he still had work to do, And this is an interesting feature of many of our African American leaders in particular. Adversity and danger did not seem to daunt them. They had a clear understanding for themselves what they were called to do. And they made peace with that. And to the extent that they could have changed things while they were alive, they were willing to put their lives on the line for that. I wanted to know what you were thinking, having heard that speech today. So we have some time at 888-874-4888 to include you. You know, I like including our listening audience, and I like trying to find out how a particular subject affected you. 888-874-4888 on this special day. I don't think we needed to be, you know, sad and mournful. I think we needed to immerse ourselves a little deeper into the mindset and the spiritual preparation and the intellectual preparation that we listened to of a leader who understood implicitly that his job was going to be multidimensional, and as a leader, he had to be prepared to fill that role. Do you think he did? Do you think he filled the role well, and he did his job well? 888-874-4888. It is important, and it becomes more and more important because many of our heroes and sheroes are dying. But it's important to not let their words and their works die with them. We must always keep them in our hearts and minds and study what they have instructed us to do, and try our very best to live up to expectations, even though many years may have passed between the time they were involved and now. But it is vitally important to keep their memories, their names, their accomplishments in our hearts. 888-874-4888. In this interview, what came out for you as one of the most significant things that Dr. King said? And why? Why do you think it was that significant? What did he say that impressed you and that caused you to say, well, geez, this is an unrehearsed interview? Daryl from the Bronx, you're on the air.
Thank you so much, Utrecht Lead, for taking my call. Happy
Thank
King
you
Day.
For calling.
And, well, just to answer the last part of what you were saying is how precisely he dissected and carefully took Sandra Van Oker's question, answered them directly with the analysis that you spoke about, the study that he had done, his speaking on the war and how it related to the poverty, how he handled the questions about the Negroes in the North. It inspired me to go back and look, go to YouTube. It's inspired me to go to YouTube this afternoon and see if I can get some more of those types of interviews, because his answers were such that the power was cloaked in a sensitivity to Sandra Vanocur's Texas drawl. I think Sandra Vanocur was from Texas. I just remember watching Sandra Vanocur when I was younger, when I was a teenager, I guess, on NBC News. It's just the way he handled that whole interview. He packed so much information into each answer, yet it wasn't, he weighed the threat of what he was saying to the American public very carefully in how he answered the question. I hope I'm making that clear.
Yes, you are.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Daryl, and I'm glad that you listened. I really am. And I'm particularly glad that you discerned some of the very important points here. King was prepared, even though he was giving an extemporaneous interview. He took things way beyond expectation and detail. So that was an extraordinary aspect of this interview. Thank you. 888-874-4888 is the number to call. On this day, when we honor Dr. Martin Luther King, we just heard from him in the course of an interview, and he touched on many points. It is eye-opening how nimble, intellectually nimble he was, how prepared he was, essentially giving one to believe, making one believe that he didn't waste time. He was always occupied in doing something that furthered his preparedness to serve. And that is one of the things that great leaders do. They study. They don't make a big thing about it, but they immerse themselves in study because they have to learn how to reach people, how to teach people, and how to make the argument that they want people to hear and to appreciate. And I think this was a splendid job. Yvette from NIAC, you're on the air.
Yes, hi. I hope this is in the... Hello, can you hear me?
Oh, yes.
Yes, I hope...
I was just saying hello to you.
Oh, hi, Lutrice. I love your show. I'm so glad. I have a sense of calm when I hear your voice come on every day.
Oh, it's wow. Like thank you.
You're like an old friend that everybody relies on, so keep it moving. I want to say that I hope that this is in the archive because there's things that I feel like I wish I wrote down. His specificity, his words were like, you know, laser-like. He picked the perfect words to say what he wanted to say, and I think that his focus on what the Pentagon and what the war budget extracts from the soul of America is what should be used to erase poverty and things that mean so much more than going to another country and killing people.
I agree with you.
You picked a perfect speech.
Thank you. I was blown away. I just said, well, let me just listen to a little bit of it, and before you know it, I couldn't move.
Right.
And I said, I had never heard it before. And when I did hear it, I said, this has to be shared. People need to listen to this.
How did you find it?
And you get an entirely different dimension of Martin Luther King.
How did you find it?
I went looking.
Well,
and took
thing.
Quite a while because there were so many things associated with him, speeches that he gave and so forth. But many people are aware of some of his speeches, but I had not heard this particular speech before, and I thought, I'll share it.
Perfect. Thank you, and thank you for the opportunity to speak.
Thank you for calling in and contributing today.
Okay.
888-874-4888. We're heading toward 0 hour on this day. It's a good day to pause and give thanks that this man existed, that he had the kind of temperament and the humility to want to be in service, which is really what pastors are called to do. And there's no question that he did his job well. And I go back to that song. It's about, what do you want me to do? And in a way, you can say that Martin Luther King's entire life was an answer to that question. What do you want me to do? What shall I do? And he made great use of his life. Of course, we regret and we hurt still the savage way in which he was killed, but you have to look at it from another point of view. He was doing his work, and it was not a surprise to him that people will respond to his loving efforts with such hateful action. All right. Ajua from New York, you're on the air.
Hi, Beatrice. Thanks
Hello.
For taking my call. Hello, can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you.
Oh, okay, I just want to make sure. Thanks for playing that. I really got to search and find it. I'm glad that when I was growing up, we heard a lot of his speeches and the real intellectual level that he was on. And one of the things I noticed in this speech, he mentioned a second level of where the struggle needs to go. He starts going to the economic level and why he started
yes.
where he was to deal with those things, and he felt that they were easier. So I guess the next stage is really for us, and we haven't really gotten there. So I really like your take on this, because a lot of what people are talking about in Martin Luther King is the same narrative over and over and over and over again. And I liked what Gary did earlier, because he was one of the first persons I have heard mention Martin Luther King's relationship to other global leaders that were spiritual yes. leaders other than Gandhi. He mentioned Merton, and he got into that. Because I can remember in the 70s, I had a neighbor who shared that part of Martin Luther King that I had never heard before, his relationship to Thomas Merton and how they had communicated with each other. So he was in tune with a lot of intellectuals and spiritual leaders, but they were very, very serious. They weren't commercialized. And today, there's so much commercialization, so it's totally absurd. I mean, celebrities can say, I'm putting on a tie and get 50 million views. It's bizarre. So thank you for sharing that.
You get all those views, but the question is, are people learning anything from...
Nothing. I mean, at least show, you know, nothing. Zero. Sometimes I can't believe it. And then you got people out here struggling to really do things, and there's no support. You know, like I think TikTok and all that other stuff and Reels is just total distractions. And these celebrities are grinning all the way, but they're making humanity worse. It's not even human. It's bizarre. It's beyond coonism. But anyway, who was the interviewer in that?
Sander Van Oker, he was an NBC newsman.
Oh, okay. That was absolutely great. And thanks, because sometimes I don't even want to listen to the regular narrative. It took us so long to communicate beyond I Have a Dream. Finally,
oh, yes.
People got to his Birmingham jail. I think that was fantastic. And then also another aspect of King that I think, which is fantastic, and thank God a 70-year-old man turned me onto that when I was 30, his literary contributions, his oratory contribution to the world, and to, not only to Christianity, but to literature in general. But it was in action. It was in doing his intellectualism. So it's no match. And
thanks, Hartwell, for contributing today. Thank you, and I'm glad that you listened.
Okay, thank you so much. Okay,
bye-bye. Wayne from Brooklyn, you're bringing up the rear today.
Thank you, Yutris. Happy Dr. King Day.
Yes,
this
you too.
This is just an example of what you do. This is the first time I am hearing this, and this is a widow. It is, this interview. To me, it must be a part of his later life because of the way he put things. In his early life, I really wasn't that interested in him because of the sort of the Christian aspect of his presentations, his addresses and stuff. But later on, he drew me in when he came more like Malcolm. And I must say that this one bring both of them, those aspects of his life together. This is a splendid interview, and I hope I could get a recording of this one.
Oh, yes, you can certainly. I'll ask when they can make copies available to people who aren't able to do it themselves. I'll ask about that and let you know.
This is great. Thank you. Just an example of the stuff that you do. Thank you, Yutris.
Thank you, Wayne. Thanks so much for calling in and contributing.
All right, bye.
Well, that brings us to, I see one call trying to get through here, and I would be very upset with myself if I don't take it. Gino from the Bronx, you're on the air, but you don't have very much time.
Good day, Yutris, and everybody else out there.
Thank you, Gino.
And his birthday is January 15th, 1929. I know we celebrate it today. So, yes, just a couple of minutes. So I got a book I would recommend people to read. It's A Testament of Hope, The Essential Writings of Martin Luther King, Jr. by James M. Washington. It came out in 1986. It's a hardcover, Harper & Row. So I it's too long to read what I underlined, but I'm going to put the ending on it for today, about what he wants people to say about his life. This is from his speech in Ebenezer Church in 1968, February. And that's all I want to say. If I can help somebody, if I can pass along, if I can cheer somebody with a word or a song, if I can show somebody he's traveling wrong, then my living will not be in vain. If I can do my duty as a Christian ought, if I can bring salvation to a world once warped, if I can spread the message as the Master taught, then my life will not be in vain. Yes, Jesus, I want to be on your right side or on your left side, not for any selfish reason. I want to be on your right or your best side, not in terms of some political kingdom or ambition, but I just want to be there in love and in justice and in truth and in commitment to others so that we can make of this world, old world, a new world. So that's that for today, Yutris. But maybe not that to read
perfect.
The whole thing
that's
from
a
speech
perfect
about
ending
the,
to our program today.
That's from
and
the
I
drum
thank
major
you for it.
Speech. Thank you.
Well, thank you. That brings us to the end of our program. I'm glad that it evoked such positive reaction from you. And we'll get together again tomorrow and talk some more. Bye-bye.